From the Moan Broadcast Centre at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Chloe Veltman, filling in for John Horn. Hope you've noticed the show's new theme music. It's by Taylor McFerrin, and he's with us today, talking about his new album.
Making art really forces you to confront yourself in a lot of different ways, and this album was the ultimate confrontation, because it's like, all right, not only did I take a long time, but now I'm going to come out with the record and I'm singing, which is like terrifying.
Also today, LGBTQ stories are often excluded or badly told in telenovelas. How a new show is changing that. And how the music of Bruce Springsteen became a guiding light for an immigrant from Pakistan. All that coming up on The Frame. Mexican soap operas are hugely popular, but they're not known for insightful portrayals of LGBTQ characters. Homosexuality remains a stigma in some Latin American countries. Heterosexual characters get to fully navigate the twisting storylines of melodramatic telenovelas, but gay couple stories are left by the wayside. A new Mexican telenovela debuted in the US on Univision last night, and it's attempting to upend that trend. Samantha Schmidt wrote about it for The Washington Post.
The show is called El Corazón Nunca Se Equivoca, which is translated as The Heart Is Never Wrong. And it's about a young gay couple in Mexico that is heading off to college in Mexico City. And this first episode, which debuted in the U.S. on Univision last night, is about that transition to college, to new roommates, and to being on their own.
Can you tell us a little bit about why this show is so significant? Why should we care about it?
So telenovelas are huge in Mexican pop culture and really all over the world. One professor I talked to compared it to soccer as one of the essential forms of entertainment. But in as much of Mexican pop culture, you know, telenovelas have very deeply entrenched gender roles, and they have never before featured a gay couple as the leading characters, as the protagonists of a series. And that's what's so significant about this, is that for the first time on a Spanish-language primetime series featured in the U.S., we see a young gay couple, not just in secondary or cameo roles, but as the protagonists of the story. And that's a huge shift.
Why has it taken us so long to get to this place where you can have two gay characters leading a show?
Well, interestingly, there have been some earlier examples of this in other parts of Latin America. Brazil, for example, has been ahead on this, but for some reason, Mexico has been a little behind. And, you know, I think a lot of Mexican culture is still very conservative socially. And, you know, we see still very strong Catholic and, Christian influence there. And also in Mexican pop culture, there's this machismo that often comes through, and this traditional masculinity that is profoundly tied to heterosexuality.
Not everyone in Mexico is applauding this new show, I understand. How has it been received, Samantha?
So we've seen some reactions kind of rippling since earlier, because the earlier season also featured this couple. And in January, there was actually this conservative politician who was tweeting that, you know, this was, you know, he was extremely critical of this, saying that this is part of, you know, trying to normalize homosexuality for youth with this pro-LGBT agenda. And he actually ended up getting criticized and expelled from his own party for that statement. And so we've seen that there's been some pushback from those social conservatives, but overwhelmingly in what we're seeing on social media, especially since this has, you know, now launched as its own series with this couple at the center of it, and now that it's debuted in the U.S., there's a lot of excitement particularly from queer Latinx communities who are seeing this as a monumental moment for telenovelas, for LGBTQ acceptance in Latino pop culture, and it's just something that we've never seen before on a telenovela.
There are, of course, plenty of LGBTQ folks who love telenovelas. What are you hearing from people who are now seeing themselves reflected in shows like this?
Oh, people are so excited. I talked to a couple of folks here in the D.C. area who have grown up loving telenovelas. You know, one man told me that, you know, he loved telenovelas so much that he actually, he's a drag queen and named his drag queen stage name after a telenovela star, and, you know, but these telenovelas had never had storylines that reflected their own experiences. A lot of the references to gay characters in earlier iterations had, like, you know, these gay characters were forced to keep their relationship secret, they couldn't hold hands, or they were kind of just these very stereotypical depictions of gay characters and were only, you know, were relegated to secondary roles or sidekicks. But to see these at the center and to see them accepted by their families, I think was huge. You know, we see even in this first episode last night, the mother defends her gay son and his boyfriend in front of a college administrator, saying, you know, they're together and they're not confused. And she's extremely affirming to them. And that's something that a lot of queer folks in the Latinx community have never seen before on a telenovela.
So you've watched the first episode. What do you think?
I thought it was, I loved that so much of it is still exactly what you'd expect from a telenovela. There's all this drama. There's, you know, some suspenseful plot twists. There's a mysterious death of a brother of one of the characters that you're not sure exactly what happened. And so there's still the same kind of, you know, suspense and drama you'd expect out of a soap opera. But there's also this, you know, you see references to so many narratives that we hear about in queer communities now, like this idea of chosen family that, you know, a lot of people, when they go off to college or move to another city, you maybe if you haven't been as accepted by your family, you have a chosen family who embraces you and affirms your identity. And we see that in the first episode where this young gay couple moves in with some roommates, and one of the roommates stands up for them, saying that, you know, your problems are my problems now, too. And I think that that's a really powerful image to see on a Mexican telenovela.
Samantha Schmidt covers gender and family issues for The Washington Post. Her piece is titled, In a First, a New Telenovela Features a Gay Couple as Leading Characters. Samantha, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
El Corazón Nunca Se Equivoca. The Heart Is Never Wrong airs weeknights at 9 on Univision. Coming up on The Frame, musician Taylor McFerrin had never sung on his own albums until now. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Chloe Veltman, in for John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Musician and producer Taylor McFerrin is from a family of singers. His father is the renowned vocalist Bobby McFerrin. His grandparents were opera singers. His sister Madison is a singer-songwriter. But up until now, Taylor has never wanted to put his own voice on record. His 2014 album Early Riser was mostly instrumental. But his upcoming record, Love's Last Chance, features vocals by Anna Wise, Elena Pinderhughes, and McFerrin himself. He also plays in the supergroup R plus R equals Now, which includes Robert Glasper, Terrace Martin and others. He tells John Horn that becoming a musician was something he arrived at on his own terms.
I went to Boston University 1 year, New School 1 year, but it wasn't for music stuff. And then I got into all these bands and I was like, I'm going to try to do this music thing for a little bit. And then I just never went back.
Is that true? You were like, I'm not going to be a musician?
No, it was more that I was like a beat maker.
Yeah.
Now, if you're a producer, there's a lot of curriculums geared towards that career path. But when I went, that wasn't really quite a thing yet.
I mean, it sounds like it was almost a natural progression. Obviously, you grew up with musicians. Your dad's a musician. His folks a musician. Brother and sister musicians. Was it inevitable or were you ever going to be a rebel and go to law school?
No, wasn't going to go to law school. But I don't know. At the time, making beats and being a hip-hop producer felt like a somewhat of a rebellion to like what my dad was doing, because he didn't get hip-hop at all, wasn't really into it, wasn't into the beats, wasn't into sampling, wasn't into like that type of music. So it felt like my own thing. But then I got good enough over time as a musician, but now we're like totally in the same world. It's kind of weird.
Was there ever a moment when people, including your dad, said, I may not totally get this, but I get what you're doing?
Well, the song on Early Riser that he's on, I had like kind of a simple beat that was looping that I had him solo over for like 20 minutes straight. And I chopped all his stuff up and made it sound like one smooth solo. And then then I added live drums later, then I added a live upright bass, and then I went to Cesar Mariano's house, who's like one of my heroes, and he added piano. So when he heard the final version of that song and it sounded like a really organic, like full, you know, composition, he's like, whoa, this is more musical than I thought it was going to be. I was like, yeah, this is one of the coolest things you've been on in a long time, actually.
Did you feel like growing up a little bit in San Francisco, living in L.A., going to the New School, did you ever feel like there was a geographical influence on what you were doing and how the cities you were living in were shaping the kinds of stories and music you were making?
100% for sure. Yeah.
How would you define it?
Well, growing up, we had really amazing radio stations in the Bay, KMEL and KSOL.
Camel. The Camel yeah. album Caravan.
So I was getting into the West Coast hip-hop scene when, like, Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre came out. It was, like, a huge issue in my school that had all these meetings with the teachers about, like, the lyrical content. And, you know,
dangerous stuff. Don't let them listen to it.
It was all over the news. Everyone was worried.
This is when Tipper Gore, Charlton Heston, all these people are saying this is, like, going to destroy this country.
Yeah. And, of course, it just made us all want to listen to it more. But then, actually, my dad, my first collection of CDs was all, you know, parental advisory stuff. He was not for it at all. I threw everything away. And it actually kind of ended up being a good thing because it's just when I started getting into music in general, and I kind of raided my parents' CD collection. But I did start getting into Stevie Wonder at that time because I realized I just checked out this one Stevie record, Fulfilling This First Finale. I didn't realize that what I would fall in love with is like Analog Synthesizer, real Fender Rhodes. So that record, Fulfilling This First Finale, I used to listen to on the bus ride to school. And that's when I fell in love with just like sonics in general. I like to see you
right across the floor. We're talking with Taylor McFerrin about his new album, Love's Last Chance. When you are working with other artists as opposed to working on your own material, do you think you're a different producer, different collaborator? Does your mindset change when it's somebody else you're partnering with as opposed to your own stuff?
I don't know. I think what ends up making it sound like my production is the instruments that I use. Like I have a couple key synthesizers that I know like the back of my hand. And there's a lot of chords that that'll make it into all my songs or certain modes I play in that make it sound like me. A lot of my buddies, like I play them stuff, is like, yep, this sounds like one of your tracks. But I think when I'm collaborating with people, it can be affected by whoever's in the room. I think I naturally am going to tailor it to what I think they would want. Or do you just start playing different things and whatever lights them up, you're like, all right, this is the one. But I don't think I changed my approach really.
You said you were tempted to or maybe thought about singing on Early Riser. Your new album, you do sing. So let's listen to a track. It's called Now Do You Need Me. I had a vision of love, but it was another place. We said forever to love, but love has gone away. Beautiful. So what happens in your mind about wanting to do it on that other album and not being able to pull it off and being able to pull it off on this record?
I'm not socially awkward. I actually really like going out and like being at events and being at shows and meeting people. But when I'm working on a project, I don't like saying that I'm working on a record and then running into the same people over and over and it's not done yet. And then I hit a certain point where I'm like, I can't go out until it's done. And then that'll turn into like a year of being like a crushing sort of like anti-social, you know, weight all over my consciousness. That happened with Early Riser, that happened with this record. And then you get to a point when you're like, do I even know what I'm doing? Like, you know, all the hyper doubt stuff that creeps in. I ended up naming this album Love's Last Chance because I recognized that was happening again. And then it started to feel like, you know, I'm just getting older. You can't just waste time and expect everything to just work out. You know, sometimes it's like you either do it now or you might not do it. And it really started to feel like that this last year. And what saved me was doing the tour with the Robert Glasper and Terrace Martin, Christian Scott group, R plus R equals now. Because we, those cats like are over all that. Well, at least it seems like it. Over the whole, like, I don't want to play stuff, like certain doubts you have. Like, they've all reached points in their career where they're just going and they have supreme confidence. Or I think sometimes it's about putting yourself in a pace where you don't have time to overanalyze things.
Meaning, let's do something and let's not spend days, if not weeks, talking about something.
Yeah.
Sounds like that would be a really kind of change your focus way of looking at the music, like, yeah, go in and work with somebody who is that fast.
Yeah, we recorded that record in 5 days. So then it was like, what? Then I felt like an idiot. I'm like, I could have put out like 20 records. But it's cool. I mean, I think this process with this record hit me in a, you know, in a really deep way. You know, it's like making art really forces you to confront yourself in a lot of different ways. And this album was the ultimate confrontation, because it's like, all right, not only did I take a long time, but now I'm going to come out with a record and I'm singing, which is like terrifying when that hasn't been my bread and butter. And I know I'm not going to be as good of a singer as I want to be yet, but the process of putting this out was like getting it started. I think the most nerve-wracking parts of it are over for me. Now I'm like much more excited about getting better and playing stuff for people and getting in studio sessions. So I can already feel, even though the full record isn't quite out yet, I just feel this momentum that's like making me much more excited.
It feels like there could be another level of stress, and that is, are these vocals your story? Are they a character story? How much of you is in them? That you kind of open yourself up to people looking at you and trying to figure out who you are, and it may be true or it may be totally wrong.
Every song on the record is a real, either something that happened or some of it's writing from a perspective of what could happen in the future and how I would sing about it in this case scenario. Now That You Need Me is me writing from the perspective of never finishing my record and my wife being like, I'm done with you, bro. I'm out. And it's like from her perspective talking to me. The next single that's coming out, Love and Distance, is all about, you know, when you're a touring musician, all of a sudden you're away from your girlfriend or your wife for a long period of time. And you're just like, why were we fighting right before I left? Or why weren't we just enjoying our time together? Or like, why don't you believe me when I'm telling you how much I love you? Like, now I'm gone. I bet you wish that we would have just been chilling. So that song's just kind of about that dynamic. I don't think I would have had the chops to make up a bunch of weird make-believe stories on this record. I had to be honest, because then I had to
have life experience.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly.
Taylor McFerrin's new album, Love's Last Chance, is out on August 16th. Taylor, thanks for coming in, and thanks for giving us our new theme song.
Hey, my pleasure, man.
Coming up on The Frame, how a Pakistani immigrant found hope in the songs of Bruce Springsteen. No doubt you've heard about Bruce Springsteen's hardcore fans. They're called Bruce Tramps, as in, tramps like us, baby, we were born to run. Our next guest shows that being a Bruce Tramp can transcend race, colour and creed. Safraz Manzoor is a writer and broadcast journalist. He emigrated with his family from Pakistan to the UK as a child. And when he struggled to adjust to school and home life, he found solace in the music of The Boss. His 2007 memoir, Greetings from Bury Park, is the basis for the new film, Blinded by the Light. The Frame's Jonathan Shiflett spoke with Manzoor about discovering Springsteen for the first time.
It was the fall of 1987, and I was 16 years old, and somebody who I had worked with had a friend, and she introduced me to him. I remember he had a turban on, he was wearing a denim jacket, and he was listening to some music. And I asked him, you know, what are you listening to? And he said, Bruce Springsteen. And I was quite cocky. And I said, Bruce Springsteen, isn't he that guy who wears check shirts and makes millions out of pretending to be working class? But he just looked at me and he just like, you're an idiot, you know nothing. And he said, Springsteen is the direct line to all that's true in the world. I just wasn't that persuaded. But then he basically said, look, you're an idiot, but I can help you. And he gave me a couple of cassettes. And that night I listened. And the song, I suppose, that particularly kind of affected me was Independence Day. Because in Independence Day, he's talking about his dad, but he's talking about him with a place of empathy, saying, look, it's just different people and they see things in different ways. And, you know, I never wanted to take those things away. And I just had never heard anything like this. And I remember thinking, this is like a story that's unfolding and I kind of want to know what happens next. And you can't touch me now. They ain't gonna do to me what I watch them do to you. I mean, my dad was, you know, a working class immigrant. He came from Pakistan in 1963. And, you know, he came and he left the country because he wanted a better life. You know, and when you're 16, you're not really somebody who spends that much time thinking about your parents as human beings. You know, you think of them as figures of opposition. And then I started hearing Springsteen, and I remember thinking, this is somebody who's trying to see the guy who's his dad as a human being who just sees the world differently. And that kind of really, that was really helpful for me. And for me, the book is kind of a love letter to Springsteen, but it's also a love letter to my parents and about that world that they came from. And after I wrote it, I was like, you know, it'd be amazing to try and get it to Bruce. The book came out, I think, in 2007, and a couple of years later he was going to be coming to London, and I got a ticket to go, and I brought the copy of the book with me. In the years previous to that, I'd been to see him so often that I had run into him a number of times, you know, not in a kind of professional capacity, but just outside hotels, or just, you know, he'd spot me on the front row and things because I was there so often. So I wouldn't say that he knew me, but he recognized me enough. And so I had the book with me, and then he comes past all the paparazzi and the flashing bulbs and stuff in the bar area. And then suddenly he spots me. I can see him walking towards me, and he walks towards me, and then he just says, your book was really beautiful. And I just absolutely just collapsed. I was shrieking, and I'm like, you've read the book. And he goes, people send it to me all the time, it's a really beautiful thing. It was such an incredible thing to write something about what this guy means to me, and then for him to acknowledge that he'd actually read it was just such a surreal experience. And so that was what sort of set me on the journey towards thinking that the idea of a film was possible. Madman, drummers, bombers and Indians in the summer with a teenage diplomat. In the dumps with the mumps as the adolescent pumps his way into his hat. Now she was blinded by a light. This was about a year after 9/11, and Springsteen was playing on the Rising Tour, and I had tickets to see him in New York. And this was going to be my first trip to America, and I was pretty stressed because I always got put into secondary, and it was allegedly random, but somehow everybody was not white who was in the room in secondary inspection. Mr. State Trooper, please don't stop me. I was like, okay, the things I do for Bruce. And so I got there, and there was a guy there, and he was like, what's the purpose of your trip? And I just said, well, actually, I'm here to see Springsteen. I'm thinking I'm going to be seeing him at the Madison Square Garden. And he's like, you've come all the way from Britain just to see Bruce Springsteen? And I was like, yeah. Please don't stop. And I thought, oh God, he's going to be suspicious. He's thinking this is a very, very bad cover story or something. But then he just like said to one of his colleagues on the other side, he said, hey, this guy's come literally all the way. And he was like, you know what? I can't think of a better reason for you to come to America. Enjoy your trip. And I was like, wow, that sort of showed to me the power of the tribe of Springsteen, really, that actually it transcends where you come from or whatever, that if you get Bruce, it's bigger than that. And so it's in the film, and it's hilarious, actually, because in Britain, it plays in a different way. But here, every time anyone sees that scene, there's like always a round of applause. This is a film that's set in 1987, but feels weirdly timely. I just think there's something quite strange about this 16-year-old kid who's a British Muslim who absolutely believes that America is a promised land. And I just think there's something quite interesting about having this in 2019. And so for me, the film is really a kind of partly a reminder of what is the best of America. And for me, Springsteen is also about that.
Blinded by the Light is in theatres on August 16th. And that's the show for today. Remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We are at The Frame. I'm Chloe Veltman. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.